Okay, our topic tonight, as we are on the cusp of the beginning of Hanukkah, is the subject of Hanukkah and the root of Hanukkah, which is Chinuch. And some of the ideas, some of the lessons that we can try to draw from Hanukkah and for the next 8 nights that we're going to celebrate together, and try to extract from it lessons about our home, about our family, about our children, about ourselves, that can carry us beyond the 8 nights, but really can carry us beyond the year. Throughout the whole year. Of course, we all know the name of the holiday is Hanukkah. And the reason, Hanukkah means a rededication, a consecration. And we know the origin, because obviously the Greek Syrians had taken over the Beis HaMikdash, had defiled the temple by entering, by conquering. Fascinatingly, it's described as Gullus. We were in exile even while in Israel. But we were exiled from the temple. We were exiled from the comfort of our own spiritual habitat and the intimate rendezvous, the place of intimate rendezvous with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. So after Hanukkah, when we had this incredible, miraculous triumph that we sing and read about in Al HaNisim, the few conquered the many, the small took on the mighty, and we had this amazing military victory, we, of course, recaptured the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, and we reconsecrated it. We rededicated the temple, particularly the Mizbeach, the altar, which is the centerpiece of the Beis HaMikdash, which the Greeks had defiled. So we know that all dedications are called Hanukkah. Chanukah HaMizbeach, Chanukah HaMishkan, HaMikdash, where if a person purchases a new home and they want to bring blessing, a positive energy into their new home, they'll often host a Chanukah HaBayis, the dedication ceremony, the consecration of their home. But what is the real root of the word Hanukkah? Where does it come from? This is a cute play on words. Chanu, Chafhei, they rested on the 25th of Kislev. That's when the holiday begins, Hanukkah. But what's the real etymology? What's the real development of this word? So Rav Shlomo Shneifel Hirsch, has a fantastic insight. He says the root of the word Hanukkah is Chinuch. At the core of the Hanukkah experience, at the core of what we're going to celebrate for the next 8 nights, is the concept of Chinuch, which begs the question, what is chinuch? What is the root of the word chinuch, of education? We usually translate chinuch as education, as inspiring, as role modeling. But what's it really all about? In fact, Rav Hirsch writes that traditionally it was customary to spend time on Hanukkah discussing and strategizing and recommitting to the importance of chinuch. That it's not just a cute play on words, Hanukkah, chinuch, chain, but really Hanukkah was an annual opportunity to reflect and to rededicate, and to think about our children, our youth, continuity, the Jewish future, and what we can do in order to positively impact it. So we know that chinuch is important. We know Jewish education is critical. But what does it have to do with Hanukkah? Is it just a cute play on words, bless you? Or does it have something specific to do with Hanukkah? So that's where the Piyazetzner Rebbe comes in. Piyazetzner Rebbe, which you have in your handout, the Kalonymous Kalman Shapira. He lived from 1889 to 1943, a relatively young man. He did not die of natural causes in 1943. He was murdered by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam Zichram. He was the Rav of the Warsaw Ghetto. He was the rabbi of the Warsaw Ghetto. He delivered the most stirring, the most moving sermons. One can't even imagine. I can tell you as a rabbi, I shudder just to imagine having to write sermons, having to stand before an audience in the Warsaw Ghetto and find words that would communicate meaning or inspiration or hope or support. And yet he did so week in and week out. He actually took notes and buried those notes in a tin can, with the hope that they would be discovered or that he himself would be able to publish them. Of course, he couldn't. When the ghetto was liquidated, he was killed together with everybody else. And later, at a later time, those scribbled notes were discovered and they were published in his work called Esh Kodesh, which means holy fire. It's been translated, it's a wonderful work, very powerful sermons, the sermons of the Warsaw Ghetto, the Piyazetzner Rebbe. But as his name suggests, he was a Hasidish Rebbe in a different town before he was in Warsaw. He was in Piyazetzner. And before anyone imagined or anticipated or foresaw the horrors of the Holocaust and how that would shift Jewish destiny forever, in Piyazetzner, as a Rebbe and responsible for an educational system, he had great fears about the youth of his time. The late 19th, early 20th century, he had tremendous anxiety about the youth of his time. What's amazing, what's remarkable is when you read his essays and when you read what he was worried about and how he thought we should respond, it is incredibly relevant, informative, and inspiring to contemporary times. I mean, 2013, we're living in an altogether different universe than 1913, and yet what he identified as the core problems then, I think very much continue to be the core problems now, and I think his answers are very much the answers. So one of the works he wrote before he was in the Warsaw Ghetto and Esh Kodesh and so on, was a book called Chovas HaTalmidim, which means duties of a student's obligation. Duties of the student, a student's obligation. It too has been translated a couple of different times, a few different versions. It's written to students in yeshiva. It's written to young people. And it's a guide how to take life seriously, how to be diligent and how to be disciplined and how to be focused and how to overcome temptation and distraction and desire, how to organize your life. It's a student's obligation. It's a wonderful book in its own right. But the introduction to the book is not written to the students. The introduction to the book is written for parents. It may be the most magnificent thing I've personally ever read. I find it incredibly inspiring. I've shared it and taught it in a lot of different contexts and venues, including at the shul, so you may have heard it before. This is the whole introduction to Chovas HaTalmidim, especially since this is being recorded. If you should really buy the book. But if you wouldn't buy the book anyway, it's worthwhile to read the copy that I'm giving you. So Rav Kalanimus Kalman Shapira, the Piazetzner Rebbe, 1889 to 1943. This is his introduction written to parents. And here he describes and answers this question. What is chinuch? What is education? He hates that word, we'll see, because it's a pedagogic, it sounds like it's a discipline, when it really loses its flavor and its warmth and its meaning. We don't have time, obviously, I mean, I'm happy to, but I don't think the Rossmans signed up for this to host us tonight, to go through the entire introduction of Chovas HaTalmidim. But at the very beginning, he defines chinuch and connects it in a way that I think is relevant to Chanukah, and then we'll see how much more time we have to go through it. So let's start. Shlomo HaMelech Amar B'mishlei, Chanuch L'Nar Api Darko, Gam Ki Yaskin Lo Yasur Mimena. King Solomon Shlomo HaMelech taught in Proverbs, train, chanuch, teach a child according to their way. That's the half of the verse everybody knows. Chanuch l'nar al pi darko. The second half is less known. Gam ki yazkin lo yasur mimena. Even when the child graduates and grows old, they will not stray. That second half of the pasuk is more important than the first half. Educate a child according to their way. Don't fit or squeeze a child into a mold, a preconceived notion. Don't tell them this is exactly as you have to be. But understand the child. Their drivers, their motivators, what satisfies them, what gives them fulfillment. Understand the child, and if you speak to them where they're at, not where you wish they were, then even when they graduate your home, they'll continue to have fidelity, to have allegiance to your values. If your whole method of parenting and education is the method of reward and punishment, of positive and negative reinforcement, then the child is just buying time till they can get out. And when they get out, they will choose what they want because they never understood the beauty, the warmth, the magnificence, the reasons, the fulfillment, the satisfaction of the values that you were trying to communicate to them. They saw it as a random system for which they were either received rewards or punishments. So gam ki yazkin, when they became a zaken, when they graduate, when they get a little older, if you want them to lo yasur mimena, if you want them not to stray, then you have to treat them, talk to them where they're at, not where you wish they were. So here he says, "Zehu ikar hachinuch shelo bilvad b'sha shanar na'ar v'yad aviv oda takif alav yishmalo v'yasek mitzvosov." Herein is the fundamental principle. This is the secret of positive parenting, of education. That the goal is not that the child should listen and obey while he's a child and under our influence. Yishmalo v'yasek mitzvosov. I'm going to take away your phone. I'm going to take away your laptop. You're not going to get to drive. No car. If that's always the answer of why you need to do something, gam kashi yigdal v'hu birshuso af ki yaskin lo yaser mimena. So you can't only communicate when they're under your power, but it has to be so much more so when they mature they won't depart. So he says, ki achinach lo tzivoy levadhu. Education is not a command. Education is not a matter of demanding. Shemetzava es b'no tamido asei kach l'kach. Here's what you have to do. Why? Because I said so. And if you don't, I'm taking such and such away. Gam lo hergel bilvadu. And it's also not a pattern of habit, of rote, of ritual. Shemargilo lasos masim tovim. It's not just that you get in the pattern. Yoser gadol v'yoser poel min atzivu u min hergel hu achinach. This concept, this principle, which really is responsible for all of Jewish continuity, and without which there's no flavor, there's no beauty, and therefore there's no continuation of the Jewish people. The essence of Chinuch, he says, is much greater than a command or a demand or rituals or habits. Ushnei Eila Tziva Vahergel Rak Klei Tashmishohim. In fact, he says, these two elements, to command or to form habits, are nothing more than tools. Kedei Lachancho B'derech Hashem. Those are tools, but those are not the fundamental mechanism. Those are not the fundamental principle. So here's where he gets to the core. As Tevas Chinuch Mefarish Rashi, Rashi in Dvarim explains what the word chinuch means. A pasuk bona bayis chadash velo chanacho. In Dvarim it tells us that if there's a war, the Jewish army is formed, it's forged, there are a number of people who are exempt from serving in the army. And one of them is somebody who builds a new home, velo chanacho. What's the root of that word? They build a new home and they didn't have a chanukah sabayis. They were not mechanacho. So chinuch lashon haschala. Chinuch means the beginning, the dedication. Adkan Lashon HaKodesh. So Rashi says, Chanacho means, Chinuch is the start, the beginning, the way everything starts. Pashat Shelo HaKol Aschala Yamar Lashon Chinuch. Now, you don't say Chinuch for every beginning. Right? The beginning of my shopping trip to Publix, I'm going to do Chinuch at Publix. A Chanukas at Publix. You wouldn't call that Chinuch. Not every beginning is called, you start the Kugel, it's the Chinuch HaKugel. Not every beginning of every activity deserves to be called, is qualified to be called chinuch. K'mor mascha beginus m'sayim b'shemach shomer sa'gemara aseid ha'gad pesach, and so on. Go to the next paragraph. Aval b'pashas lech lecha, Rashi explains, we read it recently, v'zela shono. It talks about Avram's chanichav, that Avram had disciples. And the term for disciples in the Torah for Avram is chanichav. The root, of course, is chinuch. We're going to read it in the English for the sake of time. His disciples, meaning those whom he, Avram Avinu, educated in the performance of mitzvahs. It connotes the initiation of a person or object into the trade or art for which it is destined, as in the education of a youth, the dedication of the mizbeach, or the inauguration of a house. So here, based on this Rashi, the Piyazetz Nerebbe defines the term chinuch. You know what chinuch is? Chinuch is looking at something, identifying its potential, its purpose, its future, and helping realize it. Helping reveal it. Helping usher it in. It's looking at something, whether it's turning a house into a home. You know, you spend a lot of money and you build a house. Put up the walls and the roof and the shingles. You decorate inside, beautiful wallpaper, paint, carpet, tile. All of that is a house. Chinuch, the Chanukah Sabayis, is when you stop and look and say, how can I turn that from a house into a home? What qualities make a home? The warmth and the values and the generosity and the love and the care and concern and the loyalty. What are the values that transform something from a house into a home? And it's that act, it's that moment which you determine that you're going to take it from a house to a home. That is the Chanukah Samayis. That's the Chanukah. And so he says the same is true with people, with children. That when you look at that child and you don't see what is before you at the moment, but you see who they could become. That is our job, to release that child, to realize that potential, to usher them into that destiny, to help forge that future. Not to see what's right before our eyes right now, but to see with vision for who they can become. Right? Chinuch is a person or object into the trade or art for which it is destined. The dedication of the mizbeach, the inauguration of a house. Still yet, one would not use the word chinuch to describe an artisan who begins to work if he's already an accomplished artisan. In the same vein, the connotation of chinuch would not apply to a house that's in the beginning stages of construction. The term chinuch is only relevant when describing someone who begins to learn a trade or a house that has been built but is now being used for the first time. In order to highlight the subtle nuance, Rashi was careful, for which it was destined. He was not referring to the craftsmanship nor the task, but to the person or object themselves, for the destiny, to help bring something to the destiny. So if we want to usher each child to their destiny, then we have to recognize that every single child is different. Every human being is different. Every relationship is different. No two are the same. And each one has a potential. Each one has a future that they or we are uniquely positioned to accomplish. we think differently and look differently and have different artistic ability and different athleticism and different extrovert or introvert or intellect or memory or IQ. Every one of us has different DNA, and we have different spiritual DNA, and no two people are the same. Which means that every human being is uniquely positioned to accomplish something, to contribute something to the world, to realize something about themselves. And the moment that we don't honor that, if we don't honor those differences by educating and speaking to everyone differently, then we are dehumanizing. We're taking away the human component, because what makes us human, what makes us in the image of God, is that we're all unique, is that we're all different. So the term chinuch, writes the Piazetzner, is appropriate when referring to an innate talent that a person has for a certain art, or when describing the preparation of a house or object for use. It is a special word with a specific definition, and it is used to describe the realization of latent potential inherent in a person or in an object. If we fail to actualize that potential, he continues, it will remain concealed forever. Our mission is to be mechanich, to educate the person so that he or she will become an accomplished craftsman, to prepare the house so that each room fulfills its intended purpose, to prepare the instrument so that it performs the function for which it was designed. So, I wish I could read this entire thing with you, but I want to summarize some of his main points and then get to back to Hanukkah a little bit. But says the Piazetzner, you know, the goal of education, of Jewish education, of chinuch, is not pedagogy. It's not to communicate information. When we have children memorize and spit back, they haven't been educated. They've been informed. We've embedded information. They've gone through an exercise in memory, but they haven't become transformed. They haven't been molded. And the Piazetzner bemoans, he says, we're speaking to the children cognitively, only to their brain, and we're not speaking to their soul. We're not lighting a spark. We're not turning their soul on fire. How good it feels to be generous and kind. How incredible it feels to do good for others. What it means to feel connected to something greater than ourselves. To pray to Hashem and to feel that He's listening or He answers. To be in a relationship with the Almighty. To be able to express joy or disappointment. If we don't communicate to the neshama, and all we do is give information to the brain, then we have failed the child. And the way to communicate is to understand the child. Because if we recognize each child is different, then we have to know what makes that kid tick. If we don't know them, then we can't begin to educate them. That's true for teachers, but it's true for parents. If people are blessed to be parents and to have multiple children, to know each child differently. What drives them? What gives them meaning and purpose? What is the reward that they need? Some need, you know, they did studies that have shown that all of us fit into four general categories of reward. Some people are driven and motivated by financial material reward. A big bonus at work, a reward, a pay increase. But the number one thing that most people are driven by is positive reinforcement. Most people would prefer, instead of money, you wouldn't believe this, but rather than money from their boss, they would rather their boss say, hey, great job. You know what? Couldn't have done it without you. You made a critical contribution. And without hearing, they would much rather hear that. That's a much more valuable commodity and a motivating commodity than money, or than the other motivating factors. But you know, our children also, we have to know. This child's motivated by a trip to Toys R Us, or for yogurt. This child's motivated by positive, you are amazing, you're beautiful, you're great job, you worked so hard, I'm so proud of you. This child's motivated by, every child is motivated by different things. You have to know the child. And if we fail to know our children, then we're going to fail to speak to what motivates them and fail to help them realize who they can become. We have to know a child and love a child and speak to the child's neshama, not only speak to their brain. And then he develops this idea, again, it's a long essay, and I want to get to these other things, but I encourage you to read it. He says, ultimately, what will motivate all these children is if they see it as beautiful and meaningful to us. You know, the bottom line is, let's say somebody is vegetarian, is vegan. So they can raise their children to be vegans, and it can always be, don't, if you touch that meat, you know, you slap the hand, you're going to lose your cell phone, so what do you think is going to happen when the kid's not in the house, at the friend's house? What do you think is going to happen when the kid goes off to college, goes off to the year in Israel? They're going to become the biggest carnivore that ever lived. They're going to eat cows whole, right? Because they never understood or appreciated what's the motivation, what's the reason. They always saw the parents as like, Yeah, we're giving up the meat, but you know, it's worth it. We're doing it. Woe is us. It's terrible. I crave that meat. I wish I could have it, but this is what we do. And if you eat the meat, I'm going to take away your cell phone. So that child has no chance of growing up to be a vegan or vegetarian. And I'm not, there's no editorial comment on veganism or vegetarianism here. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. But that child has no chance. Well, the same is true with Torah and Judaism and an observant way of life. If all a child hears is, Nebuch, I wish I were, Nebuch, we have to, Nebuch, it costs so much, Nebuch, my time, or Shabbos, or what I wish I could be going, what I wish I could be doing, or how much, then, and if you don't do that, I'm taking away your cell phone, if you don't do that, then what are the chances the child's going to, as opposed to showing the child that you love what you're doing, that you wouldn't have it any other way, that this isn't a compromise for you, this isn't bidyeved for you, that given all the options in the world, I would choose Shabbos. Because Shabbos is the most incredible 24 hours of the week. Liberates me in time, right? We talked about last time with Shalosh Shudas, this idea that we are the last vestige of human species who can disconnect for a full day from technology, television, telephones. Right? In our lifetimes, we will be like studied by researchers. Really? There are human beings somewhere who can turn off their phone for 25 hours? That's incredible. Right? So, and we know the benefits of that. So we have to communicate to our children, I don't keep Shabbos because my parents and my grandparents did, and believe me, I'd give anything not to, and I hate it more than you do, and I can't wait for Shabbos to end, and I'm can't, but this is what we do, and I go, oh, by the way, if I catch you violating Shabbos, you're in trouble. What are the chances that kid's going to keep Shabbos? Yes, I love Shabbos. I count down until Shabbos begins. And what Shabbos provides is a sanctuary in time and in space and the quality of time that we spend together and so on and so forth. And he points out, this is the last thing I'll say about the PSS and the Rebbe and the Chovas HaTalmidim before we get back to Hanukkah. And this is the part where I think he is so dead on. And this is, again, written 100 years ago, a little less. He says, children in our time, 100 years ago, are maturing much faster. Let me say this. They think they're maturing much faster than they are. So that a young person thinks they are entitled to opinions. A young person thinks they're entitled to conclusions. A young person thinks they're entitled to attitudes way before they are developmentally ready for it. Now, P.S. Etzler said that when he said it. I think there are two factors that contribute to this problem even more now than ever. One is endocrinology, that physically, young boys and girls are maturing, some of them, much earlier than they used to. So if a young person is physically maturing and feels that they are a man or a woman at an even younger age, they look in the mirror, they look like a man or a woman, and their parents are allowing them to dress as a man or a woman at an even younger age, then they're going to feel, I'm also entitled to think like and have decisions and have my opinion respected. So that's number one. I think endocrinologically, it's having an impact. I think I just made up a word. But number two, I just want to let you know I know that. Number two is technology. When we went to school, I have one of those, you know, when we were young moments. When we went to school, if we wanted to know something, you had to actually make it to a library and find the Encyclopedia Britannica and open it up and read about it and then remember it. Right? So you went to school and you kind of implicitly knew that my teacher, who's older than I am, who's given more thought than I have, who studied the subject, knows much more than I do. So their opinion is much more authoritative than mine. But a young person today is sitting in class and opens the phone, and here's the teacher talking, and Googles the topic. And now has 5 million hits. So who knows more, the teacher who can't figure out how to get to Google, or the kid who has 5 million websites and gazillion gigabytes of information and says to the teacher, what do you know? I've Googled it. I know a gazillion times more than you do. You can't even turn on the cell phone, and I can Google it. So I think that's also, this is not a scientific theory, it's just my own hypothesis, that I think that technology and the access to information has made all of us feel like we're authorities on everything when we know nothing, and has also allowed young people to feel that they're much older and smarter and have more experience than they actually chronologically do. So the P.S. Etzner Rebbe already writes 100 years ago. There was no technology, and maybe physically, developmentally, they weren't already, but yet he already identifies, and by the way, who's he talking about? He's talking about a group of Hasidim. He is a Hasidish Rebbe. He's talking about the Hasidish little boys with Peyas and Pia Zetzna. And he's looking at them and he's hearing from them that they think that they're Gavra. They're big stuff. They're entitled to opinions long before they are. You know, I'll never forget a class I gave to a group of high school boys, and I was talking to them about God's existence, our relationship with Hashem, and all these different things. And a couple of the boys were saying, how do you know, and I don't really believe it, and I'm not really sure, and all this other stuff. And they were saying it with certitude, with certainty. This 14, 15-year-old kid was telling me, I don't think God cares, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if God exists or God cares about my life. I know. I said, I respect your right to an opinion, and I hear what you're saying. But is it possible, I'm just asking you to consider, that at 15 years old, you don't really yet have enough life experience to say so conclusively about God? He said, no, I'm entitled to an opinion. I know as much as you do. I said, at that time, Rabbi Klein, Zichrono Livracha, was alive. I said, everyone knows and loves Rabbi Klein. I said, you know the old man, the long white beard in the front of the shul, giving out candy everybody loves? I said, you know, he lost a wife and children in the Holocaust. He lost his whole family. Everything was wiped out. Do you know that he had a daughter who predeceased him? His wife, do you know, he had a lot of hardship in his life. I said, do you know he came to shul every day in Davin and had the most emunah of anyone I've ever met? He believed in God. I said, so is it possible that Rabbi Klein at 90, living through the Holocaust, losing his whole family, burying a wife and children, and then losing another child even after the war, is it possible that his position is worth considering, and that at 15 maybe yours yet still should be developed? He said, no. Rabbi Klein has his opinion and I have my opinion, and why are you denying me my right to my opinion? I said, Pia Zetzner the Rebbe is dead on. That's part of the issue. The kid feels, it's my opinion. I once gave, it's not like every time I talk to high school kids I invoke the Holocaust, although it is a powerful tool, but I was teaching them about tefillin. And I said to high school boys, I learned with them a tshuva of Rav Oshri from Imamakim. It's a 6-volume series of responsa from the Holocaust, from the death. It's the most insane questions you could ever imagine. So I shared with them this unbelievable question, which I thought had to move them. It had to, right? A kid asked the Pia Zetzner Rebbe in the Kovna ghetto. He's 11 years old, and he comes to he comes to Rav Oshri, 11 years old in the Kovna ghetto, and he says to him, Rebbe, I've never worn tefillin. I'm 11 years old. I'm smart enough to know that I'm not going to live to my bar mitzvah. Unless a miracle occurs, I am not going to live until 13. I cannot go to my death never having experienced what tefillin feel like. My whole life, I watched my father, my grandfather, all the men. I've longed, I've wanted to wear tefillin. I want to connect the tefillin of the heart, of the head. Rebbe, is it okay for me to wear tefillin even though I'm only 11? Because I can't imagine going to my grave without wearing tefillin. So I'm telling this to this group of high school boys, and I have tears in my eyes, getting emotional as I'm reading to them this tshuva. Rav Oshri tells them, absolutely you can, because you understand what tefillin are about, and I want you to have that experience before you die. And I turn to these boys, many of whom leave their tefillin at school on Sundays and don't even bother putting them on, and I'm telling them this, and I pause, with tears streaking down my cheeks, thinking about this 11-year-old in the Kovna ghetto. And there's a moment of silence, and a boy points out the window and goes, hey, look at that plane! It's drawing something in the sky! And all the boys run to the window and start looking. Okay, that's when I realized that Jewish education was not... I went into the right choice. And these could be boys from any school in any community. These are boys in any school in any community. And one of them, when I said, you know, that boy, that 11-year-old, couldn't imagine not wearing tefillin. How could one leave their tefillin and not bring it home for Sunday morning? And you know the kid's answer was, tefillin doesn't do anything for me. Why should I wear it? You're asking me to strap leather to my arm. It doesn't do anything for me. Well, the beauty, the leather, we transform the animal and we elevate it and the godly. It's like, that's nice, but it doesn't do anything for me. And I started thinking, like, does tefillin do anything for me? And I realized most days it probably doesn't, if I'm honest. Many days it does, or I have to concentrate or be mindful to make it do something. But on many days it doesn't, I just quickly put it on to get to davening, and I start davening, and I know I'm wearing it, but I don't know that I'm really thinking about the meaning and the purpose and the... So why do we do it? And what's missing in kids today, that there's a level of brazenness. But it's what the Pia Zetzner Rebbe describes. I think it's, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to identify and isolate what are some of the challenges with youth today, and I think that's part of it. This brazenness, there's a lack of inhibition. Whereas we may have done things even though it didn't do anything for us because we were inhibited to stop because we knew we were a link in a chain and it mattered and we were part of something bigger than ourselves. A kid today says, it's 2013, I do what does something for me, and if it doesn't do something for me, why are you asking me to do it? It doesn't do anything for me. There's a brazenness. And that's what the Pious Nestor Rebbe says. And he says, proper chinuch is not pedagogy. You're not going to overcome that brazenness because you say, memorize Rashi and the Rashbam and the Ibn Ezra and the Ramban and the Pasuk. And you're not going to overcome the brazenness because you go through the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah or because you go through the Gemara and Rashi Tosos. You're going to overcome the brazenness when you touch the neshama. When you find a spark and when you light it and you fan it and you turn it into a flame. And when you touch something or create an experience for that child that makes their neshama come alive, and when they know they have a neshama and it's alive, then they'll want more and more and more of it. And then that brazenness will die down and they'll realize, the world is Torah has a lot to teach me. I don't have a lot to teach it, but I have a lot to learn from others. And he describes in detail Pious Nestor Rebbe. It's really worth reading. I can't encourage you strongly enough to read the rest of this. So according to the Pious Nestor Rebbe, Jewish education and Hanukkah share the exact same essence. Both are about dedication, are about bringing potential into reality, are about helping a person or a building fulfill the purpose for which it exists. And in both, we're bringing a greater light into the world. Jewish continuity, educating a child, speaking to that neshama, lighting that spark, and Hanukkah, where we literally light a flame, are about bringing more light into the world. So, I want to continue from Rav Hirsch's commentary on sharing with you some of the halachas of Hanukkah and applying them now to the notion of chinuch for others and for ourselves. So Rav Hirsch says, if you look at the Gemara, the basic mitzvah of Hanukkah, it's a fascinating thing. If you ask the average nominally affiliated Jew, but everybody keeps Hanukkah, there's no even electric menorah, chanukiah, that has one candle. They all have eight candles. But the basic mitzvah is ner ishu besa. The basic mitzvah, the Gemara says, is to light one candle in your house each night for eight nights in a row. It's a tremendous irony. It means that the person who's the masses of world Jewry who are non-observant are keeping a stringency when it comes to Hanukkah. They're not just doing the basic mitzvah. We have three levels, which we'll talk about in a minute. We have the basic mitzvah, the mahadran, which is the even stronger, stricter mitzvah, and mahadran mina mahadran. And universally, all Jews keep the mahadran mina mahadran. It's an incredible irony. It's not just they do the minimum to get by. This is a mitzvah everybody keeps, and everybody keeps in the most mahudr, in the most stringent way. So Rav Hirsch says, the basic mitzvah is ner ish ubeisa. The head of the household lights one candle and fulfills the mitzvah for his whole family, spouse and children, everyone is included. Says the Gemara, one does the mitzvah mahadran, enhanced means ner l'chol echad ve'echad. Each person lights their own candle. So even there, you're not lighting corresponding with the nights of Hanukkah, second, third, fourth, eighth night. You're just lighting that you light one candle, and everybody in the house lights one candle. That's the second tier. That's the higher level. So Rav Hirsch suggests that, yeah, we could live with ner ish ubeisa. We could light a fire in our heart, inspire ourselves, make sure that we're warm, make sure that we're inspired. But the proper thing, he says, is ner l'chol echad ve'echad, is to make sure that each person in our home is a burning flame, to inspire everyone to burn brightly and to illuminate on their own, to not just worry about ourselves, our virtue, our merit, our righteousness, our conduct, but to be able to use our fire to inspire everyone to burn brightly and to illuminate the darkness. So the first metaphor kind of in the halacha of Hanukkah is that, yeah, we could fulfill the mitzvah ner ish ubeisa, just lighting for ourselves, and everybody fulfills it through us. You know, let mom do X, let dad do Y, but the kids aren't invested. But the real better way is ner l'chol echad ve'echad, to make sure that everybody is involved, that everybody has a candle which is lit, that everybody has a flame. The Gemara continues and says, mahadran mina mahadran, is to light a candle every night. Here there's a debate, Rambam, Tosfos, exactly how you do it, because if you combine the two levels, then you haven't really accomplished either. Because if a person passing by now just sees a million candles, right? So if you live one per house, per member of your household, they'll know that's mahadran. But if you're one per member of the household per night, just mathematically, you get to where you're not really informing anyone of what night it is. So there's a whole debate between Rambam and Tosfos. Not for now, for another time. But the Gemara says, mahadran mina mahadran, that the highest level is to light additional candles each night. So in chinuch, in inspiring others, like in Hanukkah, you can't light one candle and think you're done. You can't teach one lesson or share one value or take advantage of one moment and then become complacent or apathetic or assume they got it. Well, that's our standard. That's who we are. That's the way it is. They should have it. Why do I have to keep saying it? Chinuch requires what the Gemara says, or at least is the opinion of Beis Hillel, mosif v'holich, to always add on, to teach more, to share more inspiration, to continue the conversation of life, to never, that our children never graduate the academy of our homes, no matter what age they are, or no matter what status of life, or no matter where they can be found, but they've never completed the teaching of their parents. It's mosif v'holich, that it continues, and that, you know, the proper, the best parent is the one who whose lessons continue to ring in their children's ears, even when they are long gone. That's Yosef, right? Last week's Parsha. I mentioned in my Parsha class this morning. Nobody talks about this, but if you look in this week's Parsha, Yosef marries Asnas, who is the daughter of Potiphar. So how'd that first Yontif go with his mother-in-law? Right? Nobody talks about that. This is the same Potiphar as in the wife of Potiphar. So I won't put it the way I did this morning when an older woman in the parsha gasped and I thought almost passed out. So I will leave it at that you can imagine what that first Yontif was like with his in-laws when given the history of so on. But in last week's parsha, when what became ultimately his mother-in-law was trying to seduce him when her husband wasn't home, right? He's serving in the palace of Potiphar. Ashes Potiphar is tempting and seducing him over and over again. She finds a day that is a pagan holiday, so no one's home, and she's confident no one will return. And Yosef is literally about to give in. Yosef, he has nothing to lose. He's not going to disappoint or earn a bad name for his family. His family's nowhere to be found, and his family seems to have care less about him. Yosef has no reason at all to overcome his urge to give in to this seduction. But he does. He's literally, the Pasuk says, he came that day to do his malacha. And Rashi quotes two opinions. One opinion is his malacha meant, that was the day he decided, I'm done. I can't do it anymore. I'm giving in. She's been seducing me. No one's home. I have nothing to lose. God, how could you do this to me? I'm stuck here in Egypt. He came to do his malacha. Rashi says, Tashmash Amita. He came that day to give in to his urge. And he's about to. They retreat to the bedroom, and you can imagine how the Medrash describes it graphically. And Yosef, at the last possible moment, about to give in to this temptation, withstands, runs out of the room, forfeits the status, the elevated employment that he had, loses it all to start again, but preserves his integrity, preserves his honor, and leaves. How did he find that strength? Where did he find that courage? Where did Yosef find that courage? Rashi quotes, he saw Demus Yukno Shel Aviv. He saw at that moment, not so romantic, but he saw at that moment the image of his father. Father doesn't mean only father, mother. He saw the image of his parents, of his teachers. He saw their lessons. So Yosef is already a grown-up, and Yosef is already a man, and Yosef is now in Egypt, and Yosef is in the most difficult circumstance of his life. And I think that summarizes our entire mission as parents, is to impart messages that will ring in our children's ears, that even when we're not there, they continue to hear our voice. That even when we're not there present, they continue to see our face. That when they're about to eat that thing, or say that thing, or do that thing, or that they hear that voice. That my mother, my father, you know? Yecheved once called me, there was a situation in with one of my kids, and one of my kids said to her, Abba wouldn't be happy if I did this. Right? And that's like the ultimate satisfying moment of parenting. That you've articulated a value, and it continued to resonate in the child, and even though you weren't there at that moment that they had to make that decision, they continued to resonate. So that's one interpretation. He heard, he saw, the lessons continued to ring in his ears. That's Mosif V'Holich. That's Chanukah. Neri Shabeso could mean I learn the Daf Yomi and I go to Minyan and I don't speak Lashon Hara. I bake challah and I say Tehillim every day and I am a modest person and I guard my tongue and I pay other people to educate my children and I hope they pick it up through osmosis. That's Neri Shabeso. That's the basic level. But really the Mahadran, the higher level for Chanukah and Chinuch, is near lechol echad ve'echad. No, is to speak to every child where they're at, to light their fire, to get their neshama excited. This child's neshama is excited through an incredible Dvar Torah. This neshama is excited by doing bikur cholim at an old age home. This neshama is excited by helping doing the cooking for Shabbos. This neshama is excited by realizing that, you know, Judaism has something to say about every circumstance. Identifying what turns each neshama on and lights that spark that turns into a flame, and to be mostly v'holich, to speak to that child so that our voice and our lessons continue to ring in their ears long after we're not standing in front of them any longer. The Gemara continues and it says, where do we put the menorah? Where do we put the Chanukiah? So the Gemara says, ner Chanukah mitzvah lahanicha al pesach beso mi bachutz. The proper place to put the Chanukiah is on the home, on the outside. Now the Gemara itself, Shulchan Aruch quotes, that in a time of sakana, in a time of danger, where we're worried that, you know, having a menorah outside the home could lead to a pogrom in Eastern Europe, hundreds of years ago. So then we were allowed to bring the menorah, the Chanukiah, inside the home. I'll just tell you a tangent, an incredible insight from the Chassam Sofer. I love to quote it every year. Chassam Sofer says, well, the sakana's over. Why aren't we putting the menorah outside the home again? I mean, in Boca, 51% Jews, it's a pretty safe bet, particularly in Montoya Circle, to put your menorah, your Chanukiah, outside the house. Why do we still bring it inside the house? Why are we lighting indoors today? So Chassam Sofer says, what's the point of the menorah? We illuminate, we dispel the darkness. Ner mitzvah v'torah or. The light of the menorah stands for Torah, Torah values. It dispels the darkness of foreign values. So it used to be, says the Chassam Sofer, once upon a time, the Jewish home was insulated. The Jewish home was secure. The Jewish home was impenetrable. So where did you need to have the symbol? Where was that sign? Outside the home. That when you left to interact with the greater world, or when you came in from that greater world, the menorah was there, but inside that home. But said the Chassam Sofer of Moshe Sofer of Pressburg already 200 years ago, now we get magazines and internet, cable TV, and all kinds of influences, they've infiltrated, they've penetrated into the home. And now that they're inside the home, he says that's why the menorah, the sakana, is inside the home. That's why we continue to light on the inside. But there's something deeper here. We're told the Chanukiah goes on which side of the doorway? If you light outside the house, which side do you put it on? On the left side. Why? So that the doorway is surrounded by mitzvahs. What's on the right when you come in? The mezuzah. So the Chanukiah, the menorah, goes on the left, so that the doorway is surrounded by mitzvahs. So the question is, well, why not just hang the Chanukiah? If we always give those learning the Daf Yomi, I'm sure in this crowd that's many of you, in the first parak of Yoma we just learned, that kol, every time you turn, your pona yamin, every time you give deference to one side, you always give it to the right side in Judaism. We always give deference to the right side. So put the menorah under the mezuzah, on the right side. Why are you putting it on the doorway on the other side? So I once saw a fantastic interpretation. It said, both the mezuzah and the menorah are on the right side of the door. The mezuzah is on the right when walking into the home, and the menorah is on the right side when walking out of the home. The mezuzah reminds us to take the values that represent what we stand for and remind ourselves of the unity of Hashem's existence when we're walking into the house. Take the values of the mezuzah of compromise, of peace, of loyalty into the house. And the menorah reminds us, take the values of Torah, take the values of principle, take the values of halacha, dispel the darkness and the assimilation outside the home. So really they both are on the right. It's just a question of perspective of which side you're coming in. There's many, many more ideas, but it's getting late. My good friend Rabbi Avi Schneider, who was here visiting recently, who was in the Kollel here in our community, now is a Rebbe in Torah Shraga in Israel, and a famous radio personality. So Rabbi Avi Schneider pointed out a great idea also that I think connects Chinuch and Chanukah. He says, you know, when you light the Chanukah candles, when you light a match, it's not, today we have those fancy lighters, but when you light a match, like the good old days, so it's not an easy thing. Think about the exercise of lighting a match. You have to push it against the grain, and you have to push hard. And the match encounters friction, but it's that tension that creates the spark, and the flame emerges. So sometimes, communicating that idea or inspiring that lesson doesn't come easy. And it's not so simple, everything's so beautiful, so everybody wants to do it. Sometimes there's friction. Sometimes you have to push hard. But it's the result of the friction and the pushing hard, it's the result of that tension that creates the spark. But he says, you know, what happens with that match? So you lit a match. Now you have a flame on the tip of that match. You don't have very long to touch it to something to keep it going. If you hold on to it for even a few seconds, what happens? It's going to go out. You have to touch the match to fuel like a candle or oil, or it'll quickly go out. And the same is true with our children. Sometimes there's tension, there's friction. It's not easy to find that neshama, to light that spark. But if we break through, if we allow it to just dissipate and disappear in a cloud of smoke, it'll disappear as quickly as it came. You have to touch it to something to make it last. You have to attach it to something. We have to find the fuel that will continue to have it burn and continue to have it go. There's one last idea I want to share. We say in Haneris Halalu Kodeshem, Ein Lan Rishus Lehishtamesh Bahem, Ela L'Osam Bilvad. We sing every night of Hanukkah that the Hanukkah candles are designed for us to look at. We're not allowed to get benefit from them. You're not allowed to sit and learn. You can't read a book. You can't benefit from the light of the Hanukkah candles. We're supposed to gaze at them, but we're not supposed to benefit directly from them. There's a very high association. There's a very deep connection between the sense of sight and the holiday of Hanukkah. The Gemara says, and the Shulchan Aruch records, Haroeh Mevarech. There's no other mitzvah. Let's say you don't have access to a menorah. You don't have access to a home. You're sleeping in your car that night. You're in transit, you're on the road, and you're not going to be somewhere overnight. So on your way to the airport, you look in the window and you see someone has a menorah. And you're going to be on a plane that night, you're never going to light the menorah that whole night. You look at that menorah and you make a bracha. Sh'asa nisim la'avaseinu. Haroeh, one who sees the mitzvah, is mevarech. Which is very unusual halacha. You don't see someone else put on tzitzis and make a bracha. You don't see someone else put on tefillin and make a bracha. The only mitzvah where you see someone else doing the mitzvah, and yet you make a bracha. The Kedushas Levi, or Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, tells us, Chanukah is the holiday of seeing. He says the different moadim, all the different holidays, correspond with the different sets. Purim is the holiday of hearing. We listen to the Megillah. Pesach is the holiday of taste. We taste the matzah, we eat the maror. Chanukah, he says, is the holiday of sight. We evaluate our sense of sight. We evaluate how well do we see. But what kind of seeing are we honing? What kind of sense of sight are we talking about? And I think it's not the physical sense of sight. In a sort of paradoxical way, our vision with our eyesight, I don't know if Larry would agree with this, can be detrimental. Our vision can be a liability. Because what happens? We live in a world that says seeing is believing. But is that true? Is there nothing true that can't be seen? Does it have to be visible for it to be true? Or are there truths that are beyond visibility? When you live in a world that's trapped by seeing is believing, that's trapped by I only accept it if I can see it with my naked eye, then we're going to miss out and lose out on authentic and genuine truths that can't be seen or observed. Our rabbis described the Greek Empire, the Hellenist influence, was choshech, darkness, right? Their galus, the galus yavan, choshech al pnei sahom, zu galus yavan, darkness, they darkened their eyes, shechshichu eneim shel Yisrael. So what's the difference, darkness and light? If we turn the light off in this room right now and make it pitch black, does it change anything about this room? The room is exactly the same. The couch, the people, the chairs, the objects. The only difference is when you turn the light on and you illuminate, you can navigate, you can see. You can get to where you want to go without stubbing your toe or tripping over something. So the difference between the lights on or off is just my perception. My ability to identify and to see the reality and the truth that was right before me all along. So I want to suggest to you for the final idea, the Chanukah is about seeing things and people and ideas and miracles that are really right in front of me, even when I can't visibly see them, that are really right there all along. The Chashmonaim didn't see the few numbers, and they didn't see the weak army, and they didn't see the impossible task. They saw the mighty hand of Hashem, and the obligation to fight, and the divine protection that would accompany them. So, Chanukah is about harnessing our sense of sight. But it's not sight as in our eyes. Ophthalmically, is that a word? Maybe? Ophthalmologically? I'm going to mix it. Something with ophthalmology. But it's not about seeing in that way. Chanukah is about vision. It's about seeing beyond that which is right in front of us. It's about beyond turning the light on to be able to illuminate and dispel the darkness to see what was in front of me all along. We have so much blessing in our lives. If we woke up this morning, if we have a roof over our head, if we have a car to drive, if we have food to eat, if we're in a loving relationship, if the people around us are healthy, we have way more than most people out there. We have blessing all around us, but it's cloaked in darkness because we don't turn the light on. And we don't notice what's right there all along. And our challenge and our goal and the idea of holiday, of the holiday of Chanukah, Neres Halol L'Kodeshem, Ein Lanu Rishus L'Hishtamesh Bahem. We're not using this light. We're using it to gaze at the light and to remember to turn the light on in our lives all around, to dispel that darkness and to see what might be in front of us all along. So to attach that to the last idea of chinuch and the responsibility of chinuch. When one looks at a child, and this is really challenging, this is the best part I left out of what he has in the Chovas HaTalmidim. Indulge me for 30 more seconds. The best part he says is, there is no categorically bad quality in the human being or among our children. There is no categorically bad quality. It's all a question of how we channel it. He gives a great example. He says, you have a child who's stubborn. So what of us, most of us try to do? That kid who insists on putting their sandal on themselves, insists on buckling the car seat themselves, insists on eating the food themselves with the fork. What do most of us try to do with that kid who's stubborn? We try to break the stubbornness. We insist, and we break the stubbornness, and we battle them. You know what he says to Pius Etzner Rebbe? Stubbornness? That's the greatest quality. Embrace it. When kids go off to college and everyone else is blowing with the wind, your stubborn kid is going to be stubborn in the values that you've taught them. That stubbornness, that persistence, that's an incredible quality. Don't try to squash it or extinguish it. Don't try to break it. Embrace it. He gives another example. He says, you know, you have, I don't know any children like this, but you could have a child who has a fire in their belly. So they're filled with love and affection and enthusiasm and energy, and they can be filled with rage and impulsiveness. And so he says, what do you try to do? We try to take a bucket of water and pour it on that fire. That kid's anger and rage, and we try to turn off that kid, right? A lot of we medicate that kid till we take away their enthusiasm and energy and personality. He says, embrace that. That fire in their belly is the greatest thing. Most other people are dispassionate in life. They're apathetic. They could care less. That kid with the fire in the belly, that's unbelievable. Just channel it. Harness it. Direct it. And he goes through all these qualities and he describes there is no categorically bad quality. It's up to us as parents to channel it and harness it and embrace it. So identify it within each child. Understand that it's what makes that child unique and special and different. And figure out how to do it. You know? I remember dealing with someone once who caused a lot of problems in the shul. He was always fighting. And so I met with him, with someone else. And like I went into that meeting thinking, I laid down the law. You got to stop fighting. You're fighting with people. You got to stop fighting. It's just not acceptable. Right? This was even before the civility story. So you got to stop fighting. But the person I was with took a totally different perspective in the meeting. And I realized they were so right. I learned so much. He looked at the individual and he said, you love fighting. You're a fighter. You were born a fighter. That's fantastic. Fight to free Agunas. Fight to free, at that time, Gilad Shalit or Jonathan Pollard. Fight Iran. I got a list. This is what he said to the guy. I got a list of things for you to fight. Just stop fighting with us. Stop fighting with your neighbors. Stop fighting with your spouse. Stop fighting with people. Here are the things to fight. So here I was, against the Pius Etzner, saying, don't be a fighter. Be a lover. Peacer. And the person I was with understood, no, you can't change a person. Some people get a geschmack out of fighting. He's a fighter. That's great. Here's a list of things to fight for. So Pius Etzner says, identify within each kid their uniqueness and channel it and harness it. But the point of chinuch, the point of Chanukah is, it's the Chag HaRe'iyah. It's the holiday of seeing. And seeing means not what's right before my eyes. Seeing means using my koach, my capacity for imagination. My capacity to have a sense of vision beyond what I see right in front of me right now. When Yosef ran out of that room, we said he saw Dmus Diyukno Shel Aviv. He saw the image of his father. My cousin, Rabbi Yonah Lazar, shared with me a different fantastic interpretation. Dmus Diyukno Shel Aviv. He didn't see the image of his father. You know what he saw? Dmus Diyukno. He saw his own image, but Shel Aviv. His father had painted a portrait of who he could become throughout his entire childhood. His father has constantly said to him, Yosef, that's beneath you. Little Yosefla, that's pastness, you're much better. Yosef, you're so smart, you could be this. Yosef, you're that. Yosef, you're generous. Yosef, you're creative. Yosef, you're disciplined. Yosef, you're amazing. Yosef, you're moral. His father had painted a picture his entire childhood of who he could become. So now at this moment of truth and of conflict, he saw that picture. And he said, if I do this right now, then I'm not becoming that picture that my father painted. To Mustayuk, no, he saw the picture of himself, Shel Aviv, that his father had painted. Michelangelo put it best. He once said, we know him as a painter, but he was a great sculptor. And he said the following quote, Michelangelo. I didn't get this just from the internet. Mom read this in a book. Michelangelo said the following. In every block of marble, I see a statue as plain as though it stood before me, shaped and perfect in attitude and in action. I have only to hew away the rough walls that imprison the lovely apparition to reveal it to the other eyes as mine see it. What an incredible idea. Michelangelo would see a block of marble. And all of us, I shouldn't say all of us, I would see a block of marble. Just a rectangular block of marble. And Michelangelo saw an incredible sculpture. And so when he was chipping away, he wasn't using his imagination and his creativity and trying to figure out what it should look like. He knew what it looked like. He already saw it. And his whole job was to reveal what already existed but was concealed within that block of marble. And that's chinuch. That's Hanukkah. That's rededication. That's the koach of sight and of vision. To see within our children already who they can become. To see the sculpture that they are. And to chip away and chip away and chip away to help them see and others see what already is plain as day to us. So I want to wish everyone a very happy Hanukkah, a wonderful Hanukkah. We should have the light of Hanukkah, the light of redemption, and the light of nachas from our children and shalom bayis, and really draw from the laws of Hanukkah to inspire the lessons of chinuch to be able to hopefully educate our children in the most beautiful way possible.